Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, the speaker is Gary Simpson. He will be speaking on bodies, bonds, and boundaries related to Commandments 5, 6, and 7. So let's listen in on Gary Simpson.
We're looking at the Ten Commandments, and you remember those, probably. And today we're going to do the fifth and sixth commandment. We're just going to pick up a few paragraphs from the fourth commandment. And at the end when it talks about, one of the things we're doing is reading Luther. What Luther had to say and kind of reading and having a conversation about it amongst all of us. So I'm not sitting up here doing some lecturing or anything today. And seeing what kinds of things we can get out, how we might argue with Luther. We may disagree with him some places, may find ourselves agreeing with him. He may be making some observations about things in his day that you might find surprisingly appropriate for our day. And I think a lot of us have done that. And we almost finished up the fourth commandment. And maybe you'll... Here's the fourth commandment. I'm going to pick it up on the second side of the fourth commandment. Pass these around. I don't know if there's enough for quite everybody. Maybe you can share it. And then we'll go into the fifth and sixth commandments and see if we can do two commandments. So finish up the fourth and then into the fifth and sixth. If you look at the second side of that sheet of paper, one of the things I mentioned the other day is Martin Luther had more to say about the fourth commandment than any of the other commandments, including the number one. The fourth commandment, as you recall, is honor your father and your mother, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. Thanks. I'll pass these around for the leftovers of the fourth commandment. And early on in the fourth commandment, Luther's been talking about the honor that he's really talking about, I think, in the fourth commandment, the importance of parenthood. And the importance of honoring parents as what he calls God's representatives or God's channels for bringing the most basic blessings into our life. And so he recognizes that parents aren't all perfect. He did not have a perfect father himself. And he interprets this commandment to mean that when we say that to honor our father and our mother, honor is actually what the Bible most often ascribes to whom should we honor? God. And so that he talks about parents and the parenthood, parents, not their person so much, but their role, what today we would call their role as parents, what he calls their office. That parents have an office, like when people put on a blue suit and a holster with a gun in it and a hat and a badge. That person is no longer, you know, Joe Blow or Jane Blow person. That person now is in an office. And that office has public expectations and is publicly accountable to the broader community for carrying out. So that a person in an office cannot do just what she or he wants to do, but actually now is fulfilling a public role for the sake of the public good and on behalf of the public. And so Luther thinks that same thing about parents. Once people become parents, they're no longer just themselves as individuals, but they are doing something for the sake of the public good and on behalf of the public. And so they have, and therefore they're to be honored. And he says that parents have a hidden, because of this office of parenthood, there is a hidden majesty into those of us who have children. And it actually flows from the majesty of God, because the most basic blessings of life come to us through parents. And he spends a lot of time talking about that. In the middle of the fourth commandment, this is from the Large Catechism, Luther talks about, he actually wants to try to talk about the totality of our life by talking through the Ten Commandments. And so he derives the whole notion of government and the institutions of government and authority, and what sometimes we call in loco parentis, you know, like teachers, anybody who has an authority over somebody else. He derives that out of the fourth commandment. That's been a rather controversial part of the fourth commandment in the large catechism through the years. And we could spend some time on that, I think. But I really wanted to get around to the fifth and sixth commandments. So I'm going to pick up just the last few paragraphs. When now he's talking about, now he's talking to parents. Earlier he's been talking to children, or to, and sometimes not just small children, but adult children. Now he's talking to parents. You see the back side down there says, more than enough has now been said to those to whom this commandment applies. Somebody want to read the next big paragraph from 167, 68, 69? Go ahead. Thanks, Sharon.
In addition, it would be well to preach to parents on the nature of their office, how they should treat those committed to their authority. Although the duty of superiors is not explicitly stated in the Ten Commandments, it is frequently dealt with in many other passages of Scripture. And God intends it to be included in this commandment in which he speaks of father and mother. God does not want to have knaves or tyrants in his office and responsibility, nor does he assign them this honor, that is, power and authority to govern, merely to receive homage.
Kind of a salary.
Parents should consider that they owe obedience to God, and that above all they should earnestly and faithfully discharge the duties of their office, not only to provide for the material support of their children, servants, subjects, etc., but especially to bring them up into the praise and honor of God. Therefore, do not imagine that the parental office is a matter of your pleasure and whim. It is a strict commandment and injunction of God, who holds you accountable for it.
Kind of interesting to think of parenthood as an office. What might that mean? For those of you who are or have been, continue to be, or might be even parents.
Responsibility.
To what? To whom?
Responsibility to bring your children up with roles, feeding them the role model of, not only one, of what it is like to live in Christian society and what it's like to be an important part, a significant part of any society.
Okay,
that
so
you just don't mate and then forget it forever on.
There's something more than biology going on here. Okay? Is parenthood, maybe parenting isn't a problem in our day and age. Probably is. It is a problem in our day and age. Well, what are some of its problems?
Lack of parents.
What does that mean?
Parents gone, absent.
Absent parents. Go ahead.
Too busy.
Oh boy, that's a interesting one, isn't it? Too busy. I must admit, I could easily be too busy.
Lack of discipline, I think. Fear to say no to parents.
That we're afraid, parents are afraid to say no to their children. Mm-hmm. Why might that be?
I'm not sure, but just I think in teaching, I think some parents are too young and are afraid their children will rebel, or are afraid that their children will not like them if they say no. Fear of not being loved maybe in return if they say no.
Interesting. Fear of your children. Do you know any parents that are afraid of their children? Interestingly enough, we're afraid that they may not love us. To be fearful of our children. Isn't that? I mean, and then we really become fearful of our children later on because they can become violent. And actually, lots of people are fearful of our children, of young teenagers, even sometimes younger.
Just to pick up on the discipline is a lack of understanding of what discipline really is.
What discipline really is.
That many people see discipline as a physical force type of thing.
Ah, yes.
Instead of a consistent example of good behavior.
I think some parents postpone parenting. They think when the child is real small or baby and toddler age that they don't have to do anything there except provide for them.
Yes.
Actually, it begins at birth, this discipline that he's speaking of, and so that they will, if that isn't begun at the very early stage, they won't grow to honor them.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of this whole thing about more, it's more than biology. There's always, there's some unevenness in the two words that we use to talk about fathers and mothers. We talk about, if you think about these two words, if you are mothered, what does it mean to be mothered by somebody? Nurture. What does that imply? Nurtured.
Nurturing.
What does it mean to be fathered by somebody?
Protection. Provided for.
Fathered? Could be provided for. A lot of times it's conceived, huh? Sometimes it ought to be, you know, provided and nurtured, but a lot of times when we use that term, just in our everyday, well, so-and-so fathered me. That means they may not be around much, but they gave me genes.
I think sometimes we believe that parenting is something inherent, that everybody can do it, just comes naturally. And it really is learned, much of a learned behavior, coming from your own parents, from what you see, how you were parented, all that kind of thing. So it's very complex.
Yeah, I expect, what do you think about this? I have a little thesis that in modernity there are some special problems in our kind of modern way of life. In the fact that a lot of us, by the time we become parents, become very disconnected from our extended families and from the role models and the people with experience that we could have kind of naturally. Whereas in previous eras, or maybe even in different cultures and ways of life, maybe, where there are generations, I grew up in the house that I grew up in. I lived with my great-grandfather, lived in our house. He was 93 when he died, and I was 10 or 11. And so it was our family was not just a husband and wife and 2.2 children. There was no such thing as, I often get kind of exercised a little bit about talking about the traditional family. Well, the traditional family is not a father and a mother and 2.2 children and 1.5 dogs. But I really came from a traditional family, 3 generations and 4. Actually, there were 4 generations, and we all lived in the same area. Yeah, so I think that this thing about being disconnected, we could spend a lot of time on this, I'm sure. Let's finish it up. The trouble is that no one perceives or heeds this. That is, that we're accountable to God as parents, that we're in a special office. Everybody acts as if God gave us children for our pleasure and amusement. Gave us servants merely to put them to work like cows or asses, and gave us subjects to treat them as we please, as if it were no concern of ours what they learn or how they live. No one is willing to see that this is the command of the divine majesty, who will solemnly call us to account and punish us for its neglect, nor is it recognized how very necessary it is to devote serious attention to the young. In fact, the whole catechism is written towards parents, but with their children in mind. So every one of the catechisms, every one of the commandments, he's dealing with how parents should be parenting their children in light of this particular commandment. If we want qualified and capable people for both civil and spiritual leadership, we must spare no effort, time, and expense in teaching and educating our children to serve God and humanity. We must not think only of amassing money and property for them. God can provide for them and make them rich without our help, as indeed God does daily. But God has given and entrusted children to us with the command that we train and govern them according to God's will. Otherwise, God would have no need of father and mother. Therefore, let everyone know that it is one's chief duty, on pain of losing divine grace, to bring up one's children in the fear and knowledge of God, and if they are gifted, to to give them opportunity to learn and study so that they may be of service wherever they are needed. Interestingly, right after this, within a year after this, Luther wrote a very long treatise called On Keeping Children in School. He was very interested, and he was advocating a system of public education for as many people as possible, for as many children as possible, including, interestingly enough, he has a whole section on why girls should go to school. He's a little ahead of his time on that one. He's not ahead of his time on all of them. But at least on this one, he happened to be. If this were done, God would richly bless us and give us grace so that people might be trained who would be a benefit to the nation and the people. We would also have soundly instructed citizens, virtuous and home. You can tell he's talking to the heads of the families, which were mostly men, huh? That time. They're the only ones that could read, which is why he's writing to have girls go to school. Virtuous and home-loving wives would be faithfully bringing up their children and servants to be godly. Think what deadly harm you do when you neglect, when you are negligent in this respect and fail to bring up your children to usefulness and piety. Well, and he keeps going on. Anyway, any closing thoughts?
Well, I think one of the things, if the children are to honor us, then we have to honor the children.
Yes.
The value back and forth. And I think that's one of the things that's really hard in society at large. We don't see that value that the children are.
All right. About being knaves and scoundrels. When you become parents, you are no longer whatever you were before. I often think, when my first daughter was born, I will never be the same. And not only do parents influence children, but adults, parents are very much also dependent upon their children. Yeah, I think we could spend a lot of time on this. Let's do the fifth and start on the fifth commandment. See if we probably won't get to the sixth. What I'm going to do is, unfortunately, we couldn't get the photocopier. We couldn't find the key to the photocopier. So I have my master sheet there, but no photocopies. So if someone would start reading, and I'll tell you which paragraphs to read. These are numbered in the side on the right column there. And the rest of us are just going to have to listen. Now he's on the fifth commandment. And you notice that you remember the commandments are divided up 1, 2, 3 that have to do with God, and 4 through 10 that have to do with now our life together as a human community. And he makes a big deal about why 4 starts out with parents. I think it has to do with our heritage, what comes before us. And now he's going to move into talking about the fifth commandment, and he also now talks a little bit, I think, about, let me get the right page for that. He begins sometime, every once in a while, he reviews why the order of the commandments is the way they are. Somebody want to read paragraphs 179 to 181. He's just kind of introducing the fifth commandment. We all know it. What is it?
Thou
shalt not kill.
We've now dealt with both the spiritual and the civil government, that is, divine and paternal authority and obedience.
Fourth commandment.
And with this commandment, we leave our own house and go out among our neighbors to learn how we should conduct ourselves individually toward our fellow men. Therefore, neither God nor the government is included in this commandment, yet their right to take human life is not abrogated. God has delegated his authority of punishing evildoers to civil magistrates in place of parents. In early times, as we read through Moses, parents had to bring their own children to judgment and sentence them to death. Therefore, what is forbidden here applies to private individuals, not to governments.
Well, you can see he is, in his own time, making what kind of an argument here? Yeah, it's not really, he's not actually making, he is kind of making an argument for capital punishment. It's not so much a positive argument. It was mostly capital punishment was, well, there was actually hardly anybody against it in his day. And probably for good reasons. It was the only reason, as we're going to find out, why this thou shalt not kill commandment is so early. It's not number 10. It's right there in the middle of them all. Today, as we think about capital punishment, we might think about, as Luther himself notes, that times change, and therefore the application of commandments also changes. So it might be interesting sometime to think about capital punishment. Maybe some of you have. We could spend a whole lot of time on that. There's a lot of wisdom that's coming now, I think, out of this fifth commandment and how Luther interprets it. It has to do, as I put on, I think tonight I talked about bodies, bonds, and boundaries. And I originally intended to do commandment 5, 6, and 7, a little ambitious. So we're going to see if we can even get bodies and bonds together, so the fifth and sixth commandment. So let's go on. Somebody want to read the next? That's kind of his, you notice the distinction he's making here. What was the distinction he made in this verse?
I couldn't hear it.
Okay, let's make sure this isn't a good room to read in. Let's make sure we read loudly for those of you who read. What kind of distinction did he make?
He said God empowered magistrates and government authorities to carry this out, but not individuals.
Not individuals. Now, he's making this it's the distinction that you just heard him make in the fourth commandment. When you have a child, you're no longer just an individual and can do whatever you want. You are now in an office. And an office is publicly accountable. You exercise an office on behalf of the whole community, and in the stead of the whole community. So you're kind of in between. And now he interprets now this commandment likewise, that governments also now are in an office. And he'll come back to why we maybe can have a discussion about why this commandment doesn't apply to the office of offices of government, but why they apply to individuals. Yeah, go ahead. 182. Yeah, just do 182. Okay. Make sure you read loudly. Okay. This room.
This commandment is simple enough. We hear it explained every year in the Gospel, Matthew 5. Where Christ himself explains and summarizes it. We must not kill, either by hand, heart, or word, by signs or gestures, or by aiding and abetting. It forbids anger except, as we have said, to persons who occupy the place of God, that is, parents and rulers. Anger, reproof, and punishment are the prerogatives of God and God's representatives, and they are to be exercised upon those who transgress this and the other commandments.
What do you get out of that? It's a little easier to follow when you have the text right in front of you. But impressions?
You don't... what do I want to say? This commandment does not concern simply taking physical life. It also concerns how we can, by words and actions, kill the spirit of another person.
Ah, yes.
That's what stuck out to me.
Now, he's going to come back to that a little later on in the commandments. Where might you think? A commandment has to do with kind of killing one another's spirit.
The eighth commandment, right?
Yeah. And so tomorrow we'll take up the eighth commandment. And he'll make the connection, and he has actually, he's following, and who does he say he's following in this kind of interpretation? Where'd he get this idea? Jesus, huh? Mm-hmm. Matthew. So he says, wait, I'm not picking up anything new here. Somebody want to try 183 to 184? Hey, don't feel you're obligated to read. Some people don't like reading in public, so, there's no...
The occasion and need for this commandment is that, as God well knows, the world is evil and this life is full of misery. He has therefore placed this and the other commandments as a boundary between good and evil. There are many offenses against this commandment, as there are against all the others. We must live among many people who do us harm. We have reason to be at enmity with them. For instance, a neighbor envious that you have received from God a better health and a state of greater wealth and good fortune than he. Gives vent to his irritation and envy by speaking ill of him.
Okay, why don't we stop there for a second. What do you hear there? What's going on? As he's beginning to get into the reasoning behind the fifth commandment. Why is it there? It's one of the most basic commandments, huh? Do no harm. There's probably not a society that's ever existed that doesn't have a thou shalt not kill commandment somehow. What's the problem with human life?
There were no structure or limit like that commandment provides, it would be chaos.
Chaos.
And we eliminate each other. It provides protection to keep some order in life.
Humans are, interestingly enough, particularly vulnerable creatures, aren't they? Mm. Vulnerable. And by thought, word, and deed of other people. It would be hard. You just think about those chipmunks out there. They're floating around. I mean, you could kill one of them. But it'd be hard to insult one of them, wouldn't it? I mean, you could probably speak ill of that chipmunk, nose to nose, and it probably would never have bad self-esteem. Humans, on the other hand, you don't have to bop them over the head with a stick. You can bop them over the head with your eyebrows. Can't you? I mean, I can bop my daughter over the head with my eyebrows. She happens to be very vulnerable these days. In fact, kids go through cycles, you know, for one reason or another. But I can kind of look at her almost unconsciously, kind of like this, and she'll almost start crying. Humans are, isn't it? That's a strange thing about human beings. You can scare the deer away, but you can't ruin their self-esteem.
It's a matter of intelligence, isn't it?
Isn't that interesting? We're more intelligent, obviously, and that makes us more vulnerable, not less vulnerable. Now, that's exactly what Luther is talking about. That human beings are exceptionally, perhaps the most vulnerable of all God's creatures. And for that reason, actually, that's why you need morality. Because we are so vulnerable. Now, there's a lot of talk around the church and around, there's somebody here who does, he's not here right now, but he does, I've met him this morning at breakfast, yesterday. Does sexual harassment workshops for businesses and things like that. Sexual harassment can take place in all kinds of, not only physical, but most of them, non-physical ways, huh? And we're finding out about, in all of our churches and all of our synods, most of the bishops of the ELCA spend 40 to 60% of their time on clergy abuse. And issues of, and the Minneapolis Synod Bishop will tell you, but all of them are on taking care of pastors who haven't maintained what do we call nowadays, professional boundaries. I had a student at the seminary a year or so ago said to me when we were talking about professional boundaries in classes, and he said, the problem is the Bible just doesn't talk about all these boundaries, that we need to have today. I said, well, why do you think the Bible calls them the Ten Boundaries? Yeah, that's what these are. These are the Ten Boundaries. Did you notice that? God, the occasion and the need for this commandment is that, as God well knows, huh? God knows how vulnerable we really are. In the biblical tradition, is tremendously concerned about the most vulnerable among us, and I think about all of us and our vulnerabilities. And so morality always pays heightened attention to the most vulnerable among us. In the biblical tradition, it's three groups of people who were the most vulnerable. Who were they? Remember?
Adam and
the widows,
the
orphans, and the sojourners, or the aliens. Widows, orphans, and sojourners were the most vulnerable. All three of those were connected. They have something in common, by the way. Widows and orphans are what?
They're alone.
They're cut off from a male, a man, the male in their life, with no societies. If you're cut off from the male. And sojourners, they're cut off from their, those days we'd call their fatherland, huh? So they are without a male in their life. That's what really makes, even male soldiers, but that's what makes them vulnerable, most vulnerable in that kind of society. So the biblical tradition lights it all over. The Deuteronomic historian in Deuteronomy and Kings and Judges, particularly the prophets as well, deal with the most vulnerable. But it also deals now with all of us in our vulnerabilities. And humans seem to be the most vulnerable of all God's creatures. We may be made just a little lower than the angels, as Psalm 8 says, but we are the most vulnerable. And Luther recognizes this, and he thinks that that's what this fifth commandment. God well knows, and what God also well knows, is that the world is evil, and this life is full of misery. In other words, there will be people who prey on other people's vulnerabilities. The issue of power. So this is all about power. God therefore placed this and the other commandments, now listen, huh, as a boundary between good and evil. The commandments, particularly the beginning with the fifth commandment, are like boundaries. No trespassing signs placed around us. Now Luther's going to interpret the other commandments as also trespassing signs. No trespassing signs. Boundaries around us. I think actually the fourth commandment comes first because it talks about that which comes before me. So that God protects even what comes before Gary Simpson for the sake of Gary Simpson. And then God protects and puts a boundary, a fence, if you will, a fortress, a mighty fortress, around even my body, as well as my self-esteem and my recognition. You do, you're a teacher, you know how important self-esteem is. A boundary between good and evil. And says, thou shalt not trespass across this boundary to this other person and their vulnerabilities. There are many offenses against this commandment, as there are against others. We must live among many people who do us harm. And so it would be easy for us to get mad back at them. And then you would just have this cycle of harm and recompense.
Gary, can I share an example?
Please do.
I'm a family physician. I've been seeing a patient who weighs about 300 pounds. He's about 30 years old, and he has a hobby of drag racing. Very quiet fellow. It took me about 4 visits before I knew he was a drag racer. And the lumber mill where we're at changed hands. They fired all the workers, and they all had to reapply. And he did not get rehired, and so he went to school in Libby. And I saw him almost every month this last year for a whole multitude of complaints, most of which were basically his nerves were shot. But he would never, ever look nervous. He was the most calm, relaxed person I've ever met. But I knew his complaints of headaches, chest pains, I mean, things that demanded certain amounts of medical evaluation were important to him. And I never got the specific story. I finally just said to him several times point blank, this has to do with this huge change in your life that you're going through right now. And he never really acknowledged that that was true. And I happened to have a medical student with me last month. And the medical student spent about a half an hour with me before I came in to see him in the exam room. They had been talking, and I wanted to talk with him briefly and see how things were going. And, you know, he was actually doing pretty well, but he always came to see me every month. He never would come. And as we were getting ready to leave, it finally came out in his conversation what had set off this neuroses that he had never experienced in his life before. And he shared with the medical student and I something in just a matter-of-fact way, unemotionally shared it with us, that when he went to reapply, for the job like everybody else did. You know, literally hundreds of people reapplied. He gave the secretary the filled out form and walked out. And as he walked out, he saw the secretary throw it in the garbage can. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, that's the reason this guy was in to see me every month. He had horrible headaches, chest pains, horrible dizzy spells. I mean, he was a basket case, but surviving. To me, that's what, you know, this is a modern example.
Yes.
Vulnerability of killing somebody, you know.
Maybe it also, you know, brought back a whole history of being killed in that way.
And how inadvertent it can be.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure that secretary had no concept of what she did.
Amazing, isn't it? Well, let's keep going on. Fifth commandment we're still on, huh?
Possessed by the devil's prompting, right there.
Yeah, let me find. I lost my place here. What paragraph is?
Half of.
Yes, right. Four. Gotcha. Keep going there. Yeah.
Okay. So the previous paragraph talked about people who were jealous of us, and then it goes on. Thus, by the devil's prompting, you acquire many enemies who begrudge you even the least good, whether physical or spiritual. When we see such people, our hearts turn to rage, and we're ready to shed blood and take revenge. Then follow cursing, blows, and eventually calamity and murder. Here, God, like a kind father, steps in and intervenes to get the quarrel settled for the safety of all concerned. Briefly, he wishes to have all people defended, delivered, and protected from the wickedness and violence of others, and he has set up this commandment as a wall, fortress, and refuge about our neighbor, so that no one may do him bodily harm or injury.
Yeah, basically it kind of picks up that, expands on that same theme again. Anything else? You want to comment on that? Violence. We all know what's going on in violence in our society, yeah? It's just a commandment about violence. And it's about bodies. Our bodies are important, as are our spirits. Huh? So Luther's got them both together here. I skipped a few paragraphs and went to 188. Somebody want to read 188 there? It's the next paragraph that I'm going to have.
Briefly then, impress it unmistakably upon the common people. The import of the commandment against killing is this. In the first place, we should not harm anyone. This means first by hand or by duty. Next, we should not use our tongue to advocate or advise harming anyone. Again, we should neither use nor sanction any means or methods whereby anyone may be harmed. Finally, our hearts should harbor no hostility or malice towards anyone in a spirit of anger and hatred. Thus, you should be blameless towards all people in body and soul, especially towards him who wishes or does you evil. For to do evil to somebody who desires and does you good is not human but devilish.
That's why he keeps upping the ante, huh? First, don't do any harm to anybody. First, by hand or deed, you know, don't kill them. Second, don't use your tongue. Third, don't even sanction any means. You know, later on he's going to talk in the Eighth Commandment about, you know, don't convene bitch sessions, gossip sessions. Tough one, that's a tough one. Finally, don't even harbor hostilities. You know, don't keep them hanging around. There's somebody doing how to deal with anger. I think I met in here earlier today. It's part of this one too. Well, let's keep going on. That's committing. Don't harm anybody. Now notice now how he's going to take each of the commandments. One of the things that Luther interestingly does, you know, now in our society, I mean, it's a perfectly acceptable law. Don't cross over the boundary and harm another person. You know, it's kind of it's a negative duty, right? Do no harm. You might call that a negative duty. And most of the laws of our country, on all levels, whether they're city ordinances, are negative duties. Don't exceed 25 miles an hour. Don't kill, don't steal. You know, also, most of the laws are negative duties, obligations, for the sake of the other person. So that they have certain, today we call those, it's the rights tradition. And actually the West
has expanded on these Ten Commandments and says the opposite side of don't harming somebody is the other person has the right to the integrity of their body, to the integrity of their spirit. So they're don'ts. And in the West, that's been called the tradition of rights. The opposite side of that, huh? And so we have certain inalienable rights. Interestingly, in the West, those have been the rights tradition was expanded to primarily, huh? All people are created by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. Who has the negative duty in our American U.S. system? These are rights that we have over against the government, interestingly enough. Now, Luther obviously lived in a different time period. Huh? Yeah. So the fourth commandment is why is so. So things changed between the time of Luther and the time of us. We could spend a lot of time on how that came about and what the implications of that are. It's quite an interesting, I think, discussion. But now Luther is going to take the commandments as he always does. Remember the small, those, how many of you, lots of you probably, don't show your hands, but a number of you probably learned the small catechism, huh? Thou shalt not kill. What does this mean? We should fear and love God that we may not hurt nor harm our neighbor in her body. Then what's the next word?
I'd love it.
But.
I'd love it.
Yeah, but. He's got these buts, doesn't he? And I call them Luther's famous buts. We've got little cans for butts around here in Holland Village, B-U-T-T. But for Luther, it's but. And so he has all these buts. But help her to help him to
positives.
Right, huh? Well, we're going to see now.
Construction on all that he does.
Right, that's in the eighth commandment, seventh commandment, help and protect their business and property. Here it's but help them in every bodily need. Interesting, like bodies. But it's this but. Now he's going to move from negative obligations, negative duties, to positive duties. Quite a different notion. So it's not only that we come up to these boundaries and we dare not cross over them into the integrity of the other person's life, but we have to do at least that much. But in the second place, we want to read 189 to 190. Where is that coming around there?
In the second place, this commandment is violated not only when a person actually does evil, but also when he fails to do good to his neighbor, or, though he has the opportunity, fails to prevent, protect, and save him from suffering bodily harm or injury. If you send a person away naked when you could clothe him, you have let him freeze to death. If you see anyone suffer hunger and do not feed him, you have let him starve. Likewise, if you see anyone condemned to death or in similar peril and do not save him, although you know ways and means to do so, you have killed him. It will do you no good to plead that you did not contribute to his death by word or deed, for you have withheld your love from him and robbed him of the service by which his life might have been saved.
Wow. Yes, that's a wow. Now, all of a sudden, it's you can't just plead, well, I didn't kill him. Nobody gets off the hook. As Luther reads the Ten Commandments, obviously, through the history of the biblical tradition.
They're all guilty.
Yes. Because there is no one, then, to whom we do not have positive obligations. Anybody who is vulnerable, we have an obligation to protect and to be and to put into place those kind of boundaries and to maintain them in all the kinds of both, I think, private individual ways, but I think today we would have to say, particularly in our modern world, in many and various kinds of institutional ways of government and all kinds of different kinds of institutions. There's a reason for that. Luther thinks that at the essence of the human being, that human beings are created by God to live outside of themselves in two directions. Luther says that human beings are... There's the gentleman that used the term. When you were telling your story earlier in the week about your
your vision. Was it your vision?
Oh, my heart operation, my out-of-body experience, yes.
Yes, but then at the end, and I heard it twice because I was in there early in the morning for breakfast, and then I was coming in for a cup of coffee when you were telling it the second time, and you say it, use the very same term right at the end. You said this was an... Oh, I probably can't see that, huh? I find any of these that work well. There we go. You called it an ecstatic experience, didn't you? Yeah. You used the term ecstatic. That is a very interesting word. Lutherans don't use ecstatic words very often. But Luther did, interestingly enough. Luther did a lot of things that Lutherans don't do. Let's see if I can find one that works better here. That's an interesting word. It's made up of two Latin words. Ecstasis. Ec is like our word for ex. Stasis means to stand. We get our word to stand. To stand outside of ourselves. Human beings are the kind of creature, unlike that chipmunk, that stand outside of themselves. In other words, we have our life, interestingly enough, paradoxically enough, outside of ourselves in someone else. And we cannot survive internally by standing only internally inside of ourselves. Now the great paradox of that is, and so Luther actually used this. He used some other terms. He said we live extra nos, outside of ourselves. You can hear the extra. And for Luther, we live outside of ourselves in two directions. And he used two words out of the Bible to kind of symbolize those two directions of how we live outside of ourselves. We live outside of ourselves, first of all, through faith. We live outside of ourselves ecstatically, or you might say eccentrically. Same kind of word, E-C-C-E-N-T, out of our center. By faith in God. So we have, if you want to do it, kind of a vertical relationship with God, in which our life, our heart, hangs on, the center of our existence, hangs outside of ourselves, God. But Luther knows that that's not enough, that somehow God created the human being to have a double ecstasis, to be doubly ecstatic, believe it or not. And the other one is that we live outside of ourselves by love in our neighbors. And so at the heart, and actually he divides the Ten Commandments up that way. Commandments 1, 2, and 3 our relationship to God, our living outside of ourselves in God. And 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 are our living outside of ourselves in our neighbors. And he accomplishes that with the buts in all of these commandments. So the buts are the going out. Not only, you know, don't harm the vulnerable person, but you live outside of yourselves in them. And your very life is your life in connection, in solidarity, in what he says, love, following the biblical tradition, in love with our neighbors. What's paradoxical about that is of all God's creatures, we also have the most highly developed, your physician, you know this, central nervous system. And so while we simultaneously are the most ecstatic of all God's creatures, we are also simultaneously the most highly centralized of all God's creatures. And it's that tension that gives humanity its specialness, I think. And also it has to do with sin. Because when our central organizing capacity rules over our eccentricity, then we tend to organize the world around ourselves. Either kind of, I think males have done it more pridefully, and females, maybe, at least in our culture, more despairingly. Does that make any sense? Or am I going
males,
off?
What? Males have done more,
well, I think
more pride? What?
Males have tended to be egocentric.
But what was the word you used?
Prideful. Pride.
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 Okay.
Often, so the sin of pride.
Okay.
In other words, we have tended to actively organize everybody around ourselves, everybody else. That's kind of, it's pretty stereotypical.
Hmm.
But that's not true in all cases by a long shot. But the stereotype in women in our culture seem to be more, the sin is not so much the sin of pride as it is the sin of despair. But you think of despair as kind of like, if you've ever been in despair, it's like, well, it's like a black hole, huh? No light can get out even. And black holes also kind of suck everything in. And so this interesting tension built into the human creature is what Luther also talks about as sin, what the tradition talks about as sin. Well, the commandments now recognize this, he thinks. And so this outgoingness, this but. You can also talk about it. The commandments always have to do with sins of commission. Thou shalt not commit, by going across this boundary. But now Luther's talking about what sometimes in the tradition has been called sins of omission. And actually he knows, following the biblical tradition, that God, interestingly enough, is more upset, so to speak, with sins of omission than with sins of commission. Therefore, God rightly calls all persons murderers, he continues, who do not offer counsel and aid to people in need and in peril of body and life. God will pass a most terrible sentence upon them in the day of judgment, as Christ himself declares. He will say, I was hungry and thirsty, and you gave me no food or drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. I was naked, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. That's a pretty famous line in our day and age, but interestingly enough, Luther builds it into the fifth commandment. Well, probably nutty to try to either go on to the sixth commandment, huh?
Isn't the whole effort of the commandments to get us out of ourselves?
Yes.
He never affirms our self-centeredness.
Oh, that's right.
I mean, he sees that as a consequential fall, right?
Yes, right.
And so that the commandments are the attempt to push us out of, right. To be eccentric people in a sense.
Yes, right. Which is why in the Small Catechism, he talks about we should fear and love God, that we may not hurt or harm our neighbor in her body, but help and befriend her in every bodily need. Help and befriend him in every bodily need. But the positive side of it, interesting, isn't in the commandment itself, is it? Thou shalt not kill. Certainly isn't the biblical tradition, and that's, of course, how he says, thinks it's legitimate to read those. What number did we quit with?
190,
huh? Well, he basically continues on there. How about if we wet our whistles with the sixth commandment a little bit? We want to start it over here? We got about 10 minutes. Now, the sixth commandment moves away from our bodies to what I call the fifth commandment has to do with bodies, has more to do with just bodies. But Luther is also concerned about bodies. Sometimes we think that the Christian tradition is spiritualized, but Luther doesn't know this kind of body-soul, body-spirit dichotomy. He's interested in bodies and spirits together. The sixth commandment, has to do with, I just tried to find another B word, our bonds. In other words, those things that are closest to us. And in the Western Christian heritage of ethics, this has sometimes been called the justice tradition. And this has sometimes been called, or if you're a student once, they actually call this a big word, the deontological ethical tradition. And if you were in school, you'd have to know that the one that has to do with our bonds, that is with the web of relationships,
that are most central to our lives. This one has to do with us as individuals, protecting our integrity. But in order to have a strong individual, you can't have a strong individual by her or himself, can you? You must have a strong social network. And so the sixth commandment now moves into our bonds. Sometimes it's called the teleological tradition, or the tradition of solidarity, or the good. We'll try a couple of paragraphs, let her whistle, and maybe we'll come back to it. Sixth commandment. Somebody want to try paragraphs 199 to 201.
199, I guess, is just, you shall not commit adultery.
Right.
The following commandments are easily understood from the preceding one. They all teach us to guard against harming our neighbor in any way. They are admirably arranged. First, they deal with our neighbor's person. Then they proceed to the person nearest and dearest to him, namely his wife, who is one flesh and blood with him. In no possession of his can we inflict a greater injury upon him. Therefore, it is explicitly forbidden here to dishonor his wife. Adultery is particularly mentioned because among the Jewish people, marriage was obligatory. Youths were married at the earliest age possible. The state of virginity was not commended. Neither were public prostitution and lewdness tolerated as they are now.
Oh, back then.
Accordingly, adultery was the most common form of unchastity among them. You want to go on?
Yeah, why don't you keep going on? Since that's kind of his just introduction, and he connects it up with, he's talking about the logic of the commandments. I've kind of done them here.
Inasmuch as there is a shameful mess and cesspool of all kinds of vice and lewdness among us, maybe I can't read. This commandment applies to every form of unchastity, however it is called. Not only is the external act forbidden, but also every kind of cause, motive, and means. Your heart, your lips, and your whole body are to be chaste, and to afford no occasion, aid, or encouragement to unchastity. Moreover, you are to defend, protect, and rescue your neighbor whenever he is in danger or need, and on the contrary, to aid and assist him so that he may retain his honor. Whenever you fail to do this, though you could prevent a wrong or wink at it as if it were no concern of yours, you are just as guilty as the culprit himself. In short, everyone is required both to live chastely himself and to help his neighbor do the same. Thus God, by his commandment, wants every husband or wife guarded and protected from any trespass.
So you got this boundary language again. But then already now in the beginning, he talks both ways. Huh? Not only are we not to cross over into the boundary of our neighbor, in other words, into their husband or wife, but we are also to help the other one. You don't cross over illegally, but you are to cross over when they're in need. So you have this two sides again, and that's the but part of the commandment. Let's read 206 and 207, then we'll quit.
Who wants to read this?
Somebody want to read the next one? Now, this is a very interesting paragraph, and it'll connect in with some of the other things we've talked about when we talked about parenthood.
Inasmuch as this commandment is concerned specifically with the estate of marriage and gives occasion to speak of it, let us carefully note first how highly God honors and glorifies the married life, sanctioning and protecting it by his commandment. He sanctioned it above the fourth commandment.
Above in the fourth commandment,
you shall honor father and mother. But here, as I said, he has secured it and protected it. Therefore, he also wishes us to honor, maintain, and cherish it as a divine and blessed estate.
Now, just before you go on with that last couple of lines there, the context is really important, isn't it? From
Luther's living at a time when marriage was disparated. It was, it was a second-class way of being a Christian. If you really wanted to be a Christian, what did you do? You went to the monastery. You forsook everyday ordinary life. And so one of the things Luther again is maintaining is that the commandments say that ordinary life is God's sacred way to bring blessings into the world. That in order to be a Christian and a good Christian, you don't have to go off. In fact, he thinks if you want to ruin your Christian life, go off to a monastery. If you want to help your Christian life along, get married. Now that's just the opposite of what the tradition had been saying, and particularly loudly in his day and age. So, he's going to talk about this institution now. Last couple sentences, then we'll get to it.
Significantly, God established it as the first of all institutions, and God created man and woman differently, as is evident, not for lewdness, but to be true to each other, be fruitful, beget children, and support and bring them up to the glory of God.
Okay, we're going to quit there because otherwise we keep going on. One of the interesting things is for him, as he sees it, marriage is the first of all institutions. I think then parenthood is the second of all institutions. Or he kind of puts them, they're pretty close together for him. But you also notice that he's got basically three reasons for marriage, which is also quite different than the tradition. The Christian tradition up to Luther's time, you got married for one reason. The reason for